one very short, sweet, factual question. I was very interested in what you said. A bit of a fraud being here. I'm not a member of, nor am I legally related to the Socialist Party, but I am representing the Anarchist Communist Federal Federation.
Could you say that again? The Anarchist...
Anarchist Communist Federation.
Anarchist Communist Federation.
I think we do have a lot of common beliefs, including some of the common beliefs about the Socialist Worker Party. I would be delighted if the talk you've given is namely in pretty form, and I could have a copy of the present form.
Well, it will be at some stage, yes. Either in the form of an article or a pamphlet or a book.
I'm in the license.
Yes. Well, leave your name and address afterwards.
Is it because of somebody's recording it, Adam?
Oh, sorry, yes, it's been recorded. It's a tape recording of it.
You'd be able to have a tape.
Well, would you prefer a tape?
When it's processed, do you have a tape?
Well, if you leave your name and address with somebody, we can forward it on to it.
Yeah, we'll make sure you get that. And if you get a copy of the Socialist Standard, which amazingly is still only 50p... this month's standard, it will indicate where to apply for other tapes on other subjects. I think that advert is in this month anyway. But yes, we'll certainly help you out there. And it's encouraging to hear somebody say that to a large extent they go along with the expose that they've heard. That's encouraging. I was hoping there would be some SWP members to defend their history and their current campaign, but apparently not. Yes,
there is a question to touch on. I mean, as you say about the quality of the membership, I mean, for the recent SWP, what do they know of their own history as an organisation when they come in and join? Obviously, they may not have time with all the paper sales that they have to do, but I mean, it's a thing that you may... you think that they would want to look into it, but maybe then again it's not.
Well, I think there is one of their members called Ian Birchall, who's written a number of articles in their journal International Socialism on the history of the organisation. So, I mean, although I said, not many people know that Cliff was a member of the Cardinal Member of the Labour Party for 20 years, that's not kept secret. I mean, they would justify that as what the circumstances of the time demanded. When you're a small group, you have to sort of be a parasite on a bigger group until you're big enough to break away. So I don't think they try to keep their history, their past history secret. But I mean, they do criticise themselves in the past for not being Leninist enough. At East End doctor David Widgery, who died, he wrote a book called The Left in Britain. And in there, he says, up until 1968, the International Socialists had a federalist structure, and that wasn't good enough. They should have gone over to democratic centralism. But by federalist structure, they meant what most people would mean by democratic structure. In other words, you would have various branches which would have a certain autonomy. They would have an annual conference. They would put motions down. Motions would be decided on, and then you'd elect an executive committee, which was answerable to the membership. I mean, they say, that's federalism, that's anti-Leninist. That was a mistake we made in the past. What we needed was a centralized, disciplined Leninist organization.
Why do they call themselves Trotskyists, or is it their opponents that call them?
Well, I think sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Well, I read out this passage from this thing they brought out in 1973 when they say we are a Leninist organisation and we're in the Trotskyist tradition. I mean, they didn't call themselves Trotskyists in the 1960s because they wanted to distinguish themselves from various rival Trotskyist groups. And in fact, I haven't brought it with me, but there's a Tony Cliff. He wrote a book on Rosa Luxemburg in which he ventured the opinion that Rosa Luxemburg's ideas on organisation were more appropriate in an industrial country in the West than were Lenin's ideas. Now, I haven't had time to check this up yet, but I mean, there's apparently a second edition of this book where that passage is taken out. So I mean, they became more and more Leninist over the years. More and more what they call democratic centralism, but I mean, democratic centralism is basically a theory of oligarchy. You know, it's a permanent rule of the leaders. They can't really be removed except by a split.
I have to thank you for a collection of £23.82, which is quite generous and will in fact cover the cost. Right. Any other questions? Yes, one at the back.
Yeah, I mean, this political party, how many disciplined members of this typical Leninist plan or what?
True.
Well, no, I mean, well, a typical Leninist way, if you like, that power isn't in the hands of the branches, isn't in the hands of the conference. Power is in the hands of the central committee, and they're the group that can expel people. I suppose they will have an appeals committee of some sort. And in fact, that's one of the things I've been trying to get hold of, which is the constitution of the SWP. I haven't actually seen one yet, but I imagine they will have a thing they would call the Control Commission. All these names, in fact, are names based on what the Russian party used to call it. But what the SWP doesn't realise, or that the Russian party copied it originally from the German Social Democratic Party. So all these, in English, you would call it the Appeals Committee or the Executive Committee and a conference, rather than a Congress and this sort of thing. But they're very closely modelled on the Russian Bolshevik Party.
Has there ever been an occasion when the IS or in its latter day form, the SWP, has there ever been an occasion when they did not support the Labour Party in a general election? In other words, when they opposed Labour Party policy, to the best of your knowledge?
They've always supported the Labour Party at all general elections. But there was this period, as I mentioned, in 76, 77, and I think into the beginning of 78, when they did put up candidates at by-elections. But I mean,
independently.
Against Labour Party. But I mean, they did that to publicise their own organisation, and they knew that they weren't putting the Labour government in jeopardy. It was done for publicity purposes. They've always supported the Labour. But I can say that in the 1970 general election, there was some members of IS who were in favour of abstaining and casting a spoilt ballot paper. And one of them was called Peter Sedgwick. I mean, he's also dead now. But he said, look, the argument you're putting forward are that we should vote Labour till doomsday, because you're saying that, you shouldn't put up revolutionary socialist candidates unless there's a chance of them winning. And they're never going to be able to win until they've got at least 30 or 40% of the vote. And his letter was in fact published in their paper. But I mean, the next week there were three people sort of saying, Sedgwick was wrong. We must support the Labour Party.
Thank you. Yes, Robert, did you want to ask?
Mention in Asia, if you look at the vote, the Labour vote of Asia, in 1959, they got 17,560 or thereabouts. At the last election, they got 1,576 votes. So that is the sort of pony clip people who got in the East Labour Party. It shows, and of course, we know a more famous member of the East Labour Party, Bob Maxwell. So how did Tony Cliff, if he's a revolutionary, get mixed up with Bob Maxwell? Because he was president of the East Labour Party when Paul Price was born.
No, but the East Labour Party, John Palmer was the person who was in Isha Labour Party, but he was selected as the candidate for Croydon North West in 64. And this other person, Mike Dowling, who was a candidate in Woking in 1966, he was also going to be the candidate again in 1969 for Isha. and he was deselected by the whatever the Labour Party's NEC is concerned, I suppose. I think they must have been the last members of IS to have been in the Labour Party, because the secretary of each Labour Party, you know, he resigned and then he joined IS, so that it was only for a period of, I don't know how many years they would have done it, for a period of 6 or 7 years they would have controlled each Labour Party.
Jim, did you have your hand up?
Yeah. Well, I suppose I'm pretty much the same as everyone else in this group. I don't think much of the SWP. And can't stand their Leninism, their opportunism, the way they patronise the working class. I think we're only fit to be followers. Follow them towards wherever they, you know, wherever they think that we're fit for. It's their capital, presumably. But I mean, are there any positive sides of the case they're putting across? You know? They're talking about socialism the whole time, and we know what they mean by that, but is there anything positive to come out of it?
Well, I mean, you see, they when they launched the SWP, they took a conscious decision that they weren't going to be any more dealing with, they weren't trying to amalgamate and form, you know, with the other various Trotskyist sects, the ING and all these sort of, they decided they're going to go out and recruit ordinary people into the SWP, and Paul Foot wrote a pamphlet called Why You Should Be a Socialist, which in fact, I don't know whether there is any, well, perhaps there's one person who'll remember, in the 1930s, John Strachey wrote a pamphlet with the same title, Why You Should Be a Socialist. So, I mean, they, you know, adopted this policy of not trying to convince other left-wingers, other Trotskyists, no, other Leninists, but trying to convince ordinary workers. And we've noticed that, you know, this has resulted in them having meetings under the same sort of titles that we do. You know, what will a socialist society be like, and is human nature a barrier to socialism, and subjects like this. I mean, they've been sort of hunting on our ground, if you like. But I mean, their view of socialism. I mean, you know, they would make this distinction that their immediate aim is this worker state in Britain, and then I think as Leninists they have this distinction between socialism and communism. Now, what they mean by communism is what we mean by socialism. I mean, you know, they're prepared to concede that in a communist society, sometime in the distant future, the state will disappear. There'll be no buying and selling. There'll be no money. There'll be no wages system, and they'll be from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. But I mean, in fact, they've got one pamphlet which has got a title similar, like, you know, what will socialism be like? And they say the first thing that'll happen when we get socialism is there'll be a wage increase. You know, and so they are adding to the confusion. I suppose the one good thing you can say, and I think with some of these people in IS in the 1970s, when they were acting as a sort of service organisation to the rank and file movements. I mean, you know, they were quite sincere people. I mean, some of them, I've heard of people mortgaging their houses and giving half their salaries and so on to help these sort of movements, and. I mean, some of them have become members of our party. I mean, I know at least four, and I discover them every day. I was down in Wiltshire the other day talking to a member, and I said, I'm doing this talk in this book called Pamphlet on the SWP. He said, I was in the SWP, well, the IS it was called, in fact. And he said that he was a member, he was a student in Bath. And he said, there were two workers in our branch. Two print workers, well, but not realising that they're workers as well, because they didn't. But I think some people might get introduced to ideas of, you know, there's something wrong with the profit system. There is a class struggle, you know, going on in society. And certainly, for all the differences between our theory of state capitalism and theirs, I mean, they did publicise amongst sections of the working class the idea that Russia wasn't socialist and was nothing to do with socialism, you know, state capitalism. But I mean, the leaders they must be a cynical bunch of people, you know, because I mean, I think that they had success with the Anti-Nazi League, and they formed the Anti-Nazi League just before the last general election. I think they reckoned that Labour was going to win, and they know that under a Labour government, organisations like the National Front and the BNP do better than under a Tory government. So they were anticipating, you know, a Labour government coming in, the BNP growing in strength as Labour inevitably failed, and then they could relaunch the Anti-Nazi League and recreate history. So I mean, I think, you know, they cynically wanted a Labour government so there could be, you know, a rise of the BNP so they could have a mass movement. I think that's how they do things.
Thank you. The back there.
Yeah, if going into this boot recruiting campaign, how are they? Are they going to put their finances on a different footing? Because my understanding is that they've always been financed as a sort of sect with sort of huge punitive contributions from all the members. You know, people being moral and blackmailed into giving large amounts to collections and things like that. And they're not going to get that from sort of people who join on a whim. Are they getting financial backing from somebody, or are they going to make even more demands on the, shall we say, more permanent members?
No, I don't think there's any you know, Moscow Gold or Libya Gold, which is like Jerry Healy's organisation. They were financed by Iraq and Libya for a while, one of the workers' revolutionaries. But no, I think they get their money by taxing their own members. I mean, this thing which I picked up thinking was a membership application form is in fact a banker's order form. But I mean, they certainly pay a lot more than members of the Socialist Party pay, or even the most generous of us. I mean, they pay a lot of money.
If they're recruiting people in their thousands on a whim, then financially they're
collapsing. Well, I mean, I suppose their treasurer knows what they're doing. They'll be getting some money from these new people for some period of time. But as I said before, I was talking to a member of another Trotskyist organisation, and he was saying, on the Miners' March, a member of their executive committee joined the SWP. Well, literally, all you had to do was fill in one of these, something come to you and say, join the SWP. Oh, yes, I'll fill it in, and then you join. I don't suppose he actually paid any money for them at a later date. No, I think they've decided, because there's nothing else happening. I mean, there isn't anything happening, well, anything much happening. There's nothing like the anti-Gulf War thing or the anti-Peltec thing going at the moment. So they get their members worked up to a pitch of enthusiasm, and what they're getting them to do now is to recruit more members. I think, and I'm sure, that who they are recruiting is the readers of Socialist Worker, because I mean their membership is 4,000. I'm prepared to believe that, and if their sales are something like 20,000. I mean, they've got a bit of scope for getting some of those people who buy the paper regularly to say, why didn't you become a member? And if they make the conditions less strict, in other words, you don't necessarily have to attend a branch meeting or pay too much, or I was talking to one ex-member who was in our party, and he was saying they have to do 6 hours party work a week, or they have to get leave of absence. Maybe these are good ideas, each member taking 3 copies of the Socialist Standard and doing 6 hours of Socialist Party work a week.
They have commissars to enforce it.
I think they get fined if they don't do it, yeah.
Discussion, any criticisms of the... of the Socialist Party? We've had a lot of criticism of the SWP.
Could I ask another question?
Oh, another brief question, yes.
When you talk about socialism from below, has that been a parliamentary road to socialism, or do they not put up candidates? And also, you mentioned their association with the anti-Nazi League.
Yeah.
Did they start the anti-Nazi League, or is it just a sort of something they climbed on the bandwagon?
Well, to answer the second question first, they started the anti-Nazi League, and they did quite well. They got lots of Labour MPs to sponsor it. I mean, Neil Kinnock was one of the sponsors of it at one time, and they got Peter Hain to be the front person, and he's since become a Labour MP. And when they restarted it, he's again the sponsor of it. Now, this term socialism from below. I've used it, but in fact, it's not a scientifically accurate term, because it implies that there's a top as well. I mean, basically, but what it means is that, as far as we would be concerned, would be people organising themselves democratically to establish socialism. Now, what they mean by it is, I'm not sure, because this is the big contradiction in their position. They use phrases like self-organisation of the working class, self-emancipation of the working class, and they say that trade unions, for instance, should be organised democratically, that the executive committee should be composed entirely of lay people who are not of full-time officials. But their own organisation is organised on exactly the opposite principle. It's all political parties in Britain, except our own, are organised on the basis of leadership. But I mean, in an organisation like the Labour Party or the Tory Party or the Liberal, there's a sort of informal leadership, and the in the trade unions as well. I mean, the trade unions have all got democratic constitutions. But I mean, this theory of Leninism is a conscious theory of the leadership, institutionalised leadership, and not only do the workers need leaders, but the members of the party need leaders, and it's the people who are the central committee are regarded as more informed, it is, if you like, control from above. That that's how the SWP is organised. So I mean, I think there's a contradiction here between what they preach, which is socialism from below, so called, and what they practice, which is a party organised from above. No. Well, I mean, so they have put up candidates in by-elections, and I don't think, I mean, they're not an anti-parliamentary organisation. I mean, they at some stage, they might be prepared to put up candidates, but they would say that the time isn't ripe. I think they did support that candidate in Liverpool, whatever, left candidate in Liverpool, left Labour candidate, or whatever it was in Liverpool. I mean, at some stage, for instance, in Northern Ireland, they support Sinn Féin. That's what they say. If you're in Northern Ireland, you should vote for the IRA. So, I mean, they don't put up candidates, but it's just because they think the time isn't ripe yet.
Don't they have a section in their where we stand called no parliamentary vote?
Yes, I mean, he said, don't they have a section in where we stand no parliamentary vote? Yes, but I mean, there's two different things. They believe in going in to Parliament as a tribune, to use it to get publicity. I mean, Lenin wrote a famous pamphlet, he did write it, in 1920, called Left-Wing Communism, an Infantile Disorder. And he was arguing against people in the early Communist Party in Britain and in Holland and Italy and so on, who argued that there should be abstention from elections, that the members of the Communist Party shouldn't participate. He said that they shouldn't have any illusion, according to them, that Parliament controls the state. So I mean, you're not going to get state power through elections and Parliament. This is their theory, but you can still use Parliament and elections for publicity and agitational purposes. I mean, so they're not anti-parliamentary in the same sense as our friend here would be, I suppose, in the anarchist federation, Communist Federation.
Right. Discussion? Anybody? Yes, George.
Three things I'd like to say, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the complaint. Secondly, a comment on a point the speaker made right at the beginning of this talk. And thirdly, to come to the main issue of this talk, our complaint is that the chairman assured us we were going to have a high profile exposure. But the speaker didn't restrict things at all.
You just
come back with it. Now, the initial intermediate point the speaker made at the beginning of this talk, he was speaking about Russia, state capitalism, and saying, as the party regularly say, that this party has been giving the correct account of the Russian condition since 1917. Now, I'm not going to say that Russia was not what the party says it is. What I do point out is that in order to make this explanation, the party has to move away from the position taken in its Declaration of Principles. This explanation does not reconcile the Declaration of Principles. The Declaration of Principles speaks quite clearly of ownership of the means of production by a capitalist class. What the speaker said and what the party consistently says about the Russian situation is that the Russian leaders monopolized control of the means of production. They do not speak in terms, they do not claim that they owned them. Now, this is a different thing from what the Declaration of Principles Now, to get to the main point, we know the speaker was cut short, perhaps he would have said himself more. But what I would like to say, to do, is to pick up what he said and add a little bit to it and carry it a little bit further. One thing he did not, for all this detailed information, much of which was new to me, that doesn't mean I question it at all. He did not advance any explanation for the presence of the SWP. And in fact, on the party's analysis, two classes in society, it is impossible to give an intelligible explanation of political divisions and political conditions in terms of relationship to class. Only two classes, there are far more than two very distinct political positions, outlook, attitudes. What you find in the political field is a range of positions, attitudes, or ways of thinking about politics. This is a big complicated subject, I'll outline it in 30 seconds. At one end, people who simply do not think about politics but accept the conditions as they find them. Next to those, conservatism, which is in favour of present conditions, feels it's under threat, tries to defend it. Next to that, along the range, liberalism, can see things wrong with present conditions, tries to correct these things to perfect them. Next to that, the Labour Socialist, not the whole of the Labour Party, but the Socialist part of it, trying to reform the existing system. Next to that, people trying to revolutionise it. And beyond that, the Socialist Party, which used to be the SPDB, which and the anarchists together, who say it's not good enough even to try to revolutionise this society, the only thing to do is to abolish it and make a fresh start on intelligible principles. Right, now when you have, you close that range, covers the main political positions, the SWP occupies the revolutionary part of it, in between the Labour Party and the anarcho-socialists, and you will note, the speaker himself pointed out, the SWP came up as the Communist Party went down. There is that position in this range which is going to be occupied by one political movement or another. Communist Party went down, SWP came forward to occupy that position. Now, to take the speaker's argument one step further, and I've almost finished, the speaker went as far as predicting the decline of the SWP. And as far as I know, he may be perfectly right. But I will take that further, and I will say that if he does turn up right, and the SWP does decline, even disappear, another movement will come up to occupy that same position in the political range. The position often described as Leninist or Trotskyist. They're much the same thing, except that they have different, looked at different heroes. And it is that range of political positions, rather than this very much oversimplified conception of two classes, which explains political behaviour and the SWP, its rise, its probable decline, and the coming forward of another movement to take its place.
Do you want to deal with those now?
If you want to, but I mean, there might be somebody else who wants to join in.
You should deal with the, why do we call it capitalism?
No, but I mean, well, okay. I mean, I must confess, it's the first time I've ever heard you, over 30 years, ever expose your own political views instead of making carping criticisms. But anyway, so better late better late than never. But let me deal with the question of ownership. Now, I mean, there are two ways of interpreting the word ownership. One is in a strict legalistic sense, and the other is in a broader sociological sense. Now, it's our Declaration of Principles, and I say we're the ones that are in a better position to interpret what it means. I mean, I think the word ownership doesn't just mean that somebody has a legal property title to it. I mean, that is the icing on the cake. What ownership means is that, as a matter of fact, you know, of social practice. There is a group of people who are able to exercise, you know, certain decision-making powers over how the means of production are used. So, I mean, you, in Russia during this period, at least during part of this period, you had people who, because they controlled the state machine and the means of production, were state-owned. They were the, if you like, to use another Latin word, the de facto owners of the means of wealth production, whereas the capitalists in a country like Britain, you know, to use the same Latin term, they're the de jure owners. In other words, they are the owners in law. But I mean, as has been said, you know, was it possession is 9 points of the law. So I mean, the people who possessed the means of production in Russia, they were the owners, the virtual owners, whatever it would be like. I mean, they in as far as the social relationship with the rest of the population were concerned, that was the position they were in. The ruling class in Russia, the ruling class in Britain were in basically the same position. So I mean, that's how I'd deal with that particular point.
Of course, what we should have said in 1904, you know, a dozen years before the Russian Revolution, was when we refer to the capitalist class, or those whose role is such that they function as if they were the capitalist class. Now, I grant you we should have written that in to clause 6,
well, you do, but I don't.
Or whatever it is. However, I mean, some members are shaking their head and saying, no, it's not necessary, you know, because most people know, you know, that declaration of principles is a brief, succinct distillation of a whole body of theory, and even you would not expect every I to be dotted and every T to be crossed in 8 short clauses. However, I grant you that in our literature, we ought sometimes to qualify what we're saying.
Well, incidentally, Les, the word monopoly does appear in the decorative. We don't want to get involved in a textual analysis of a historical document.
I think most people would accept that. If the effect of that party apparatchnik control, the nomenclatura's control, and their access to the wealth, and their right of disposal of the wealth created, sole right of disposal, distribution of the wealth created by the working class, I think most people would accept that you might as well say that they were acting as if they were an owning capitalist class. Although, you're right, strictly speaking, they didn't have the stock certificates or the share certificates. Well, however,
they've got them now anyway.
They've got them now.
According to the Russian vice president, that's all Yeltsin's been doing. He's been handing them over to the...
Can we call them the capitalist class now? Wait 5 years, because wait for the dust to settle, and then the capitalist class themselves will be revealing their identity in the world conferences and the G7 and the Big Five and the Conference of Rome, when all the Russian new entrepreneurial capitalists start exercising their worldly power because of the wealth they own, then perhaps you won't criticise us anymore for calling them the capitalist class.
Nobody suggests that Russia is anything but capitalism.
Right.
Members of the working class don't ride around in limousines and live in palaces in the countryside.
Down the centre of the road, which is restricted to all but the apparatchnik. You're right. Who's next?
I was quite interested in this gentleman's categories on the second bit. I don't want to get involved in sort of what society is best constituted based on the ownership of the means of living. Because if somebody's a ruler of state, do you own these means of living, or do they who owns them? That's a little bit abstract for me. But your categories that you invented there, have you got those in written form in that little journal you produced? Because I'd be interested in reading those and analysing those. Because you do seem to have a sort of static view of society, like you have this view that society is never changes and never evolves. And from what the little you said, it does seem to me to have that sort of attitude, so I'd like to go into further analysis, if I may. But I mean,
it's a meeting of the Socialist Party, not of thing. But I mean, I can point out in his journal, on the front inside page, there's always a pyramid. You see, at the bottom of the pyramid are the Conservatives. Then there's the Liberals. Then there's the SWP. And then there's the anarchists and SP. On the top is George Walford himself. this is.
As a neutral, objective chairman, I ask you to take note of the fact that our friend George says that is a lie, and I think it is. I think myself, I have to endorse that. It's a joke. It's a good joke, but we know you don't mean to be at the top. It's not at the top of the pyramid. I know you're not. It's that halo above the top of the pyramid. That's where you are. Right, way, way above the apex. So, anyway...
Chairman, now we've got down some serious problems. Instead of all this nonsense that the Socialist Party has carried us...
Well, I was going to see if anybody else wanted to criticise the Socialist Party, because I don't think you should monopolise the criticism. There's so much to criticise, so much where we need putting right, that I'm sure there are other people that want the opportunity to do so. You know, I mean, our friend from the Anarchist Communist Federation might want to put in his two pence. I don't know.
I read in Peter Marshall's Demanding the Impossible one brief paragraph which says that the girls' objectives and principles of the Socialist Party are not only dissimilar from those of the anarchist movement in general, but anarchist communists in particular. That was the first, and I think only mention I ever saw of the Socialist Party there or elsewhere. I also note that next Tuesday in Surrey, North London, we have a meeting with the title Society Without Government. So I suppose the question I would really like to ask is, given that anarchist communists believe that the goal is not to seize power but to abolish it, and that there should be no state, what is the Socialist Party position on the state and on perhaps more broadly as an emergent property of the state of nationalism?
Well, I mean, we've always, defined socialism, if you like, in a when we define it in a negative way, as a classless, moneyless, stateless, wageless society. So we don't envisage socialism as having a state machine. But of course, you have to define what you mean by state, and what we mean by state is the machinery of coercion, the public power of coercion, if you like, the armed forces, the police force, the law courts, and all prisons and the police and so on. I mean, that's what we mean by the state. And our, according to our analysis, that is only necessary when you have society divided into two classes. When you have one class which effectively, you know, monopolises the means of wealth production, and they need a state machine to enforce their rules. So when you've established a classless system of society, you don't need this public power of coercion, so it's abolished. So I mean, you know, that was why, when in my talk, I said this phrase "worker state," you know, as far as we're concerned, it's a contradiction in terms. There can't be a worker state. There can't be a socialist state. Now, our main difference with those anarchists who are communists or socialists, I mean, because there are all sorts of anarchists who believe in, I don't know, anarchist individualists, and people like Proudhon who believe in free banks and funny money and so on. But I mean, you know, those anarchists who actually believe in abolishing private property and means of production and common ownership. I mean, our difference with those anarchists is as to how we think such a system of society could be established. I mean, we think that, well, first of all, you have to have a majority of the working class, and the working class are in fact the majority in society, over 90%. You must have a majority of people who are in favour of getting rid of capitalism and establishing a socialist system of society. Now, we say once you've got a majority in favour, then under circumstances in countries like Britain, you can use the electoral system to, well, you know, gain a majority in Parliament and, you know, formally wind up the capitalist system. I'm not hasten to add straight away, it won't be the people who are MPs who will do that. I mean, they'll just be sort of messenger boys for the majority of people organised outside Parliament and organised in a political party at work and so on, ready to take over and run society. It's just, if you like, to capture control of the state to prevent it being used to by the ruling class to hold up this establishment of socialism. But I mean, see, we've rejected consciously since about 1944 the whole idea of any transition period that socialism can be established immediately. So I mean, we don't even have the idea of a transitional government or a transitional worker state. Transitional workers' regime, the so-called dictatorship of the proletariat, the things which Marx talked about in the last century. So I mean, that's our basic position. As far as we're concerned, socialism is a society without the need for a coercive state machine. But as the coercive state machine exists today, it's got to be at least neutralised. And the easiest way to do it is when you've got a majority, you just use your force of numbers to gain control over local councils and the central elected body.
I might point out we do distinguish ourselves from mutualists, syndicalists, and individualists. We are very much anarchist communists. From what you said, should I take it that you would endorse representative democracy? And in that case, how does one move away from the conception of Vanguard?
You see, I mean, I don't know what you mean by a representative democracy. You mean electing representatives? Yeah, but no. Obviously,
delegation.
That's right. I was going to say. I mean, we use the word delegate, and I mean, our own party is organised on this basis. We have a conference, and this branch can appoint two or three delegates to go to that conference, and they're mandated how to vote. So, I mean, I think in a socialist system of society, you couldn't operate on the basis of direct democracy. I mean, there must be some delegations, but these people will be, let's say, the mandated delegates of the people that elect them. I mean, if in fact there's some other tier where you have to send somebody to some regional body or even to some world body, then these will be delegates. Once again, on that basis. I mean, the theory of MPs is that they can sort of represent themselves, and they're elected. Leaders. I mean, we're against that conception of so-called democracy, in Russia you have this self-perpetuating bureaucracy or oligarchy. In Western countries, the politicians, they're elected leaders basically. But I mean, we're against unelected leaders as well as elected ones.
Presumably, delegates are something we agree on.
Well, I mean, more or less immediate. I mean, obviously, I mean, we have an executive committee, and we did try to recall some executive committee members in the last 20 years. I mean, it's not quite immediate. You have to have, it's got to be done in accordance with procedures. You've got to find, six branches to get a thing, and then it can be within 2 months anyway. Yes, I mean, they're subject to recall and replacement if they don't do it. I still think that. We still think that you do need a sort of formal procedures to be laid down to do this. I mean, that's the only way you can ensure that things are done properly. But I mean, we make these rules ourselves. It's our own constitution and similarly in other working class bodies.
Could I just add? In our experience, we found that. By observing problems and difficulties of other organisations, that to abolish, to get rid of autocratic control and decision-making leadership and that kind of authoritarian policy-making and domination, to get rid of that and not replace it with some kind of a book of rules, democratically agreed, and some kind of democratic set procedure
and accountability, procedures for accountability, procedures for disciplining, procedures for calling to account and requiring explanation, requiring retraction or a change, or requiring a change of policy or of activity priorities. All of these things, if you've got rid of the autocratic leadership principle, you dare not have nothing in its place except individual preferences and individual waywardness. Because then the situation can, from the point of view of proceeding towards a socialist society and achieving some sort, the situation then is just as bad as if you had the autocratic authoritarian leadership problem. So what we've developed over the 80 years, 90 years or so, is a intensely democratic procedure. So democratic that the minority always has, if you like, a greater access to publicise their ideas, argue their case, than the majority. So conscious of the need for democratic participation, all that, that all our internal procedures and the rule book and everything is geared to achieving that kind of control by the membership, decision making by the membership, policy making by the membership at large, and not just encouraged as a theoretical good idea, but actually an obligation on them. You know, I mean, special meetings and all that sort of thing. I won't go into all the details, but the formalized procedure ensures that every member is equal. Every member, as soon as you join, 14-year-old joining the party has the same opportunities, rights of participation and decision making as an old wrinkly like me that's been in the party for, you know, more years than I care to think. So in that situation, you do need some sort of procedural certainty, some kind of guidelines and rules by which each individual can exercise those democratic rights that we hold so important. That's, I think, the difference. That is probably one of the differences between the Socialist Party and some aspects of the anarchist movement. You know, I don't know if that sort of makes it clear, or if you want to come back or what.
Well, maybe we ought to talk Adam and Lockheiser, so maybe we ought to talk
before. Over a pint of beer, perhaps.
We also have our aims and principles.
Yeah.
Frequently updated, and the rules that you have their equivalents with us as
right.
well. Those rules are decided by each and every member.
That's
of
good.
The
That's
Federation.
Good. It's obvious we've got a lot in common. At the back there, yes.
That person wanted this.
Right, oh, okay, yes.
I'd like to support something George said earlier on. I think you look at society, you find there must be different classes. Several classes, not just two. And I think Marx himself made the point that when he studied the French Revolution, he followed the historians of the French Revolution. And at that point, people did say there were several classes in society. First, there were the peasants, there were the military, there were the clergy, and there were the law people. And these four elements constituted a basis of the society before the French Revolution. And everybody agreed to that. And I think Marx himself based a lot of his ideas on what the historians said happened. So I think it's obvious thing to say that there's always been different classes, anytime, anywhere. It happens the way you arrange your classification. But there's certainly more than two.
But, I mean, if you're talking about a period now before the French Revolution, what they had in France before 1789, I mean, you had a capitalist economy, but you had a sort of political structure that was inherited from feudalism, and you did have it. You're quite right. They had these estates. You know, I mean, there was nobility, and there was the clergy, And then there was the, you know, the third estate, which was the common people, you know, the lower classes, as you call them. But these were legal estates, and a similar thing existed in Russia in Tsarist times. You were either a member of the nobility, and incidentally, Lenin was a member of the nobility as far as this classification was concerned. And then you had the intelligentsia, and then you had the merchants, and then you had the peasants. But these were, if you like, pre-capitalist political forms. Now, I mean, the thing about, I mean, and even in fact, when capitalism has developed, it sweeps away these sort of feudal estates, and you're left essentially with two classes, or rather at the beginning three classes, because in Marx's Capital he assumes that there is a separate class of landowners, who, and then you've got a class of capitalists, and then you've got the people who work for wages. And I mean, you know, what has happened over the past century is that, you know, the landlord class and the capitalist class have merged. I mean, economically and also through marriage. I think today, I mean, you know, of course, you're quite right. You can use any form of classification you like, but I mean, the classification we use for defining classes: what is the relationship to the means of production? And basically, there are only two left in a country like Britain. There's the class which owns or monopolises or controls or disposes of the means of production, and the class which doesn't, which is the vast majority of us. So, I mean, we on our definition of class, there are two classes in society. But I mean, you can sociologists use other things. They define classes by consumption patterns, accents, what school they went to, and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, they start off and they A1234, B1234, C1. I mean, you can do any. I mean, I'm not saying that those classifications are invalid, but I mean they're not the same as the one we make, which we say is the most important one.